Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read, where we're delighted to present a great story by a frequent and most welcome contributor to our show, Fresno author Jim Ashford. Jim is going to read a kind of tongue-in-cheek science fiction story that he entitles Mayday. Here he is, Jim Ashford.
Mayday! On a bright May morning in 2013, in an unprecedented display of international unity and abject fear, the President and Vice President of the United States, the Cabinet, the Justices of the Supreme Court, every member of Congress, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, high representatives of every major religion, and the ambassadors of every nation on earth, except North Korea, stood in formal splendor on the south lawn of the White House, respectfully arrayed by office and nation and rank. Beyond the fence to the south, on the grass ellipse leading up to the Washington Monument, and east and west all along the National Mall stood at least 2 million people watching on giant video screens arrayed along the space. Elsewhere around the world, billions watched the broadcast of the scene. In Washington, everyone, from the president to the lowliest citizen, was silent. And as noon approached, all eyes were raised anxiously to the sky, toward the hum of the rotors of an approaching helicopter. It was the President's own Marine One that cruised slowly across the tidal basin to hover over the lawn, just in front of an honor guard of members of the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, and high-ranking officers from every military force in the world, except North Korea. The Marine Band began to play softly the 1789 hymn paraphrasing Psalm 90, O God, our help in ages past. The helicopter slowly dropped to land on the grass. When the engines stopped and the rotor blades began to wind down, the band segued to the Reformation hymn, A Mighty Fortress is Our God. The president turned to the vice president and said, Are you scared? The vice president answered with one word that was not yes or no, but described a lack of excrement. The helicopter's rotors slowed and stopped. In total silence, the assembly stared at the door of the machine as it slowly opened to reveal a short old man, balding, wearing heavy rimless glasses taped together at the nosepiece, a rumpled plaid shirt, worn overalls, and very old and scuffed high-top work shoes. He hesitated, blinked, turned to look back into the helicopter, and then, as if urged forward by a remark from within, awkwardly descended the steps that had been lowered from the aircraft. Accompanied by the Luther hymn's solemn chords, the man walked slowly and uncertainly toward the president. From somewhere, the amplified voice of David McCulloch, recognized by everyone present or watching around the world, as the narrator of every documentary ever shown on PBS, intoned, Mr. President, members of Congress, justices of the Supreme Court, honored clergy, representatives of the nations of the earth and their military, except North Korea, ladies and gentlemen, I present Mr. Homer Slard. A muffled cheer arose from the multitudes along the mall. The president nodded, and all the military officers snapped to attention and saluted. The old man hesitated, then stopped and drew himself precariously erect and awkwardly returned the salute, albeit with the wrong hand. The president stepped forward, smiling nervously, shook the man's hand, and said loudly, "We appreciate what you've done, Mr. Slard. I hope that you will enjoy your visit to the White House." Then the president leaned forward and whispered, "But if all this goes wrong, your very sorry ass is in deep, deep trouble." Then the president and all those present on the lawn of the executive mansion turned their heads to look at the door of the helicopter. A very tall figure was emerging, clad in a kind of uniform with a flowing cape. The figure bumped its head, looked up at the doorway, rubbed its head, and, some later claimed, smiled in its way. And how did all this come to happen? It began at a Home Depot in Fresno. Homer Slard was a 71-year-old man of no accomplishment or ambition. He had been born and raised on a small farm in the Central Valley of California, had graduated from a high school in a rural town near Fresno, but never considered going to college. A patriotic young man, he was nevertheless rejected from both the draft and voluntary enlistment in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and National Guard for being overweight and flat-footed. His only employment, aside from helping on the family farm, had been 50 years as a janitor in a fruit packing house. Homer was a passive and, some might say, a colorless man, but he was not ignorant nor technologically illiterate. He had a home computer. He simply had never achieved, nor wanted to achieve, wealth, power, or celebrity. He had no interests except reading fiction, cruising the internet, or streaming movies from Netflix. He was partial to books and films of science fiction. Homer never married. He lived in a small house on the family farm, left to him, an only child, by his parents, in the east part of the valley, just off County Road 6. One late April day in 2013, Homer had ventured to Fresno in his 1968 four-door Plymouth Plaza, also left to him by his parents, to buy paint at a Home Depot. The porch of the farmhouse was looking shabby, he had decided. As it turned out, he never bought the paint. On the way into the store on Kings Canyon Road, he chanced to see a display of solar-powered ornamental garden lights. For some reason that he could not later explain, and the FBI and the National Security Agency later surely gave him many opportunities to do so, he stopped and picked up a box of the lights. The box contained three individual small LED lights mounted on the end of slender metal stakes about 2 feet high, to each of which was attached a hollow plastic disc containing a small solar panel that in turn charged a AA-sized nickel-cadmium battery. Over the top of each light, packed separately, were to be mounted, respectively, a clear plastic-molded life-size hummingbird, butterfly, and dragonfly. The box declared that the lights, mounted in the garden to catch the sun's rays, would in the evening cause the plastic creatures to glow with soft light that would slowly change color randomly from red to blue to green to amber and so forth, well into the night, until the battery's charge was exhausted, to be renewed by the next day's sunlight. Homer was intrigued. He thought how pleasant it would be to have these lights glowing in the small field behind his house. He bought a box, forgetting that he had come for paint for his porch, and returned home. That afternoon, he put together the lights and their insect and avian models. First, however, Homer carefully read the instructions for assembly and use, the Consumer Product Safety Commission's one-size-fits-all warnings, more fitted to assembly and use of a laser weapon than a garden light. Quote, "Keep your work area clean and well lit. Keep bystanders, children, and visitors away while assembling and operating this product. Always wear eye protection," and on and on. Homer, of course, knew that the lights, assembled with only a turn of the wrist and having a maximum electrical potential that of a single AA battery, hardly merited the somber warnings. On the other hand, he had always respected authority and its official pronouncements, even the most banal. That night, Homer stood in his backyard and watched as the three devices planted in the field slowly went through their cycles. He was delighted. The next day, he returned to the Home Depot and bought four more boxes of the lights. That night, he was even more delighted as 15 lights, now arranged in the field in something of a large circle, glowed and winked, silently casting their butterflies, hummingbirds, and dragonflies' random colors into the night sky. A week later, sometime after midnight, Homer was awakened by a knock on his front door. He rose from his bed, slipped a light robe over his pajamas, and walked slowly to the door. He turned on the porch light and peered through a small dusty window in the center of the door. A tall figure wearing some kind of cape was standing back from the door. Homer couldn't make out a face. He called out, "Who's there?" He heard in reply, the sound seeming to come from within his head rather than from outside on the porch, a soft, "I am here." "Who are you?" Homer shouted. "I am who I am. I am here," the voice in Homer's head intoned. It seemed almost musical, melodic. "Just a minute," Homer shouted. He turned and walked quickly to a hall closet, rummaged around in the back and returned, carrying an old Mossberg 410 bolt-action shotgun he'd last used as a boy to hunt pheasant. He pulled back the bolt. There was a very old shell sitting in the chamber. Homer wondered whether it was any good anymore. He slammed the bolt forward. The sound filled the room. He slipped off the safety and walked slowly back to the door. The voice again filled his head. "Why do you fear me?" Homer shouted, "What do you want?" "I have come as you asked me to come." "Why do you hold a weapon?" Homer became aware that the stock of the gun was becoming warm. He looked down just as the bolt slammed back by itself, ejecting the shell onto the floor. The voice called again. "I am here as you asked me to come." Then the lock clicked and the door opened by itself, pushing Homer back into the room. "Hello," said the voice in Homer's head. Homer stepped farther back as the very tall figure began to enter, bumped its head on the doorframe, then stooped down into the doorway and seemed to glide into the room. The being, for want of a better noun, was wearing a gray uniform of some sort with a full cape. It was not precisely human, but did have only two arms, two legs, one head, two eyes, and a nose and mouth, all arranged in a familiar human-like form. The being had flowing red hair, and the face looked like an unnerving blending of the actors Christopher Walken and Willem Dafoe. "Thank you for allowing me in," said the voice. "Not much choice I had," said Homer. His words caught in his mouth. His hands were shaking. He leaned the empty shotgun, still warm to the touch, against the wall. "We will talk," said the voice. And they did talk into the remains of the night. "I saw your signal," said the voice. "What signal?" said Homer. "The lights that called me," said the voice.
"You mean," Homer said.
"The lights that called me," said the voice. "The lights signaled that I was desired, and I have come." "We need names, yes?" said the voice. "My own you could not pronounce. For the time being, you may call me your visitor." "Visitor," Homer repeated. "And you?" The visitor's green eyes blinked. Homer said, "I am Homer Slard." "Homer Slard," said the voice.
"No," Homer said, "it's Homer Slard."
"Yes," said the voice, "Homer Slard."
"Close enough," said Homer.
"Where are you from?" said Homer. The visitor was silent. "Are you an angel?" Homer asked. The visitor smiled. The voice laughed and said, "Homer Slard, you may see me as you wish."
"And why are you here?" Homer asked.
"As I said, you asked for me, you sent the signal, and I came," said the voice.
"But why do you answer a signal?" Homer said. The visitor sat silently for a moment. Then the voice seemed to whisper,
"Homer Slard, I took your signal as a cry for help, and I have come to help your planet." Homer, by now willing to believe that he was not dreaming and not hallucinating, and that his visitor might in fact be some kind of angel or otherwise extraterrestrial, thought back to scores of books, movies, and jokes, and began to giggle.
"Why are you laughing?" asked the voice.
Homer said, "You're going to say something to me, I know." The voice said, "You know what I will say?" Homer nodded and said, "You're going to ask me to do something. I just know it." The voice hesitated, then spoke. "Well, as a matter of fact, I must ask you to take me to your leader."
"Bingo," said Homer.
Later the next morning, Homer and his visitor sat on the back porch sipping coffee.
"This is most excellent," said the voice. "I could become used to this."
"Be careful what you wish for," Homer said. Then he cleared his throat and said, "You know, I can't do what you ask me to do, to take you to my leader."
"Why is that so?" said the voice.
"After all, you were the one who signaled to me. Surely you are authorized to do this."
"It was only chance and accident," Homer said. "I'm just ordinary. Nobody knows me, not anybody important in authority. For sure, not the president. I'd be arrested if I tried to take you to—"
"You must try, Homer Slard," said the voice, but this time with an air of command. Then more softly the voice said, "You know, sometimes things happen for a reason. Sometimes the act of a single person, perhaps inadvertent, nevertheless speaks for all. A cry for help, perhaps." The visitor nodded at Homer,
then said softly, "May I have another cup of this most excellent beverage?" And so it was that Homer sat down at his computer that day and wrote an email addressed, quote, president@whitehouse.gov. "Dear Mr. President, I have been contacted by a visitor from someplace outside the galaxy who wants to meet you. The visitor says that it is very important for the planet that you meet directly. Sincerely, Homer Slard." And 15 seconds later, in the White House, a 22-year-old graduate of Harvard who was spending that summer as an intern in the communications room of the executive mansion turned to another young aide and said, "Jesus, another nutcase. Check this out. And look, he even capitalizes visitor." And then, whistling the theme from the Twilight Zone, she sent back the standard White House reply to correspondents who claimed to have made contact with extraterrestrials. "Dear Mr. Slard, thank you for your note and information. The president is always pleased to hear from his fellow citizens concerning matters of importance to the nation and world. Unfortunately, because of pressing national and international problems, the president will be unable to meet with your visitor from outside the galaxy. Sincerely, Mrs. Ellie Arroway, White House Communications Aide." Homer thought, at least she capitalized visitor. "See," said Homer, pointing to his computer screen. "I told you it wouldn't work." "So," said the voice, "let us try another message, Homer Slard." And he told Homer what to write. "This," said Homer, "is going to get us in a whole lot of trouble." The second email that Miss Ellie Arroway received that day read, "Dear Mr. President, the visitor I wrote you about says that you had better meet directly or there will be terrible things happening to the country and world. Sincerely, Homer Slard." "Mother of God," shouted Miss Arroway. "This is a live one." And with a keystroke, she forwarded Homer's emails to another federal office, and a great machinery powered by authority and paranoia lurched into motion. Late that same afternoon, two special agents of the United States Secret Service drove up to Homer's farm. They were followed by a county sheriff's car with two deputies. The agents got out of their unmarked sedan, adjusted their coats and ties, checked their holstered pistols, whispered briefly into their lapels, and began to walk briskly toward the front door of the farmhouse. Some 20 feet from the door, the lead agent abruptly bounced backwards as if he had run into a wall. His nose began to bleed. "Damn," he muttered. "Damn," his fellow agent said. The two gingerly reached forward until their fingers stopped against clear but solid air. Then the two began walking slowly apart, their hands and fingers following the outlines of an invisible barrier, like two officially sworn mimes doing trapped in a box. The sheriff's deputies watched in amusement. When the agents met each other at the back of the house, the first said, "We need some backup." The second said, "You got to take care of that nose." The first said, "I think it's broken." By the next morning, the little farmhouse was surrounded by 16 special agents of the Secret Service, 27 county sheriff's deputies and the sheriff herself, 38 reporters and photographers from 13 different countries, 12 television trucks with crews that included 12 elaborately coiffed on-air reporters, 5 of them named Tracy, 4 named Kelly, and 3 named Mark, each holding microphones and looking stern but sincere. There were also, with the special agents, four government-sent-trained German shepherds named, respectively, Rex, King, Buddy, and Stud. Overhead, a military helicopter circled cautiously in company with seven television station helicopters. Cars of civilians jammed the roads leading to the farm. Beyond yellow tape labeled Do Not Cross, Crime Scene, three evangelical preachers held prayer vigils and loudly and happily predicted the imminent end of the world. They were competing for attention with four persons who claimed to have been abducted and intimately probed by aliens. All of the abductee/probees were hawking self-published books about their experience. At noon, the special agent of the Secret Service with a bandaged nose held up a bullhorn and solemnly said, "Attention, Mr. Homer Slard. By authority of the United States of America, you are hereby commanded at this point in time to egress your dwelling immediately with your hands in the air and to offer no resistance to sworn officers of the United States." 1 minute later, to the surprise of everyone, the front door opened and Homer stepped out. The air filled with the clack and whine of automatic cameras. A moment later, the visitor stepped out onto the porch, bumping its head on the doorframe. The photographers backed away in quick step, but still shooting. All of the special agents and sheriff's deputies drew their weapons. Two Tracys, one Kelly, two Marks, and Rex, King, Buddy, and Stud whimpered, turned around, and ran behind the television trucks. This is my visitor, shouted Homer. My visitor wants to see the president. And then everyone, including the media, the civilians, and the evangelists and abductees, probies, heard the voice in their heads. Fear not. I have come in peace. I must speak to your president. A 40-year-old deputy sheriff, a recently born again among the armed legions, thinking he had suddenly been possessed and was hearing the voice of the devil, panicked and pulled the trigger on his automatic rifle. Bullets ricocheted off the invisible barrier and back into the television trucks. Everybody hit the ground. The special agent picked himself up, brushed off his coat and trousers, and adjusted his tie and bandage. He walked toward the porch until he ran again into the invisible wall. Stepping back with tears in his eyes and rubbing his nose, he raised the bullhorn and began to speak. Damn, sorry about that. Well, Mr. Homer Slard and your visitor, whoever, it is not possible to speak with the president because... But his words were drowned out by the voice. Well, then, I shall wait until it is possible. And the visitor and Homer turned and went back into the house. The visitor, careful this time not to bump its head on the doorframe. Inside, Homer turned to the visitor. That didn't go so well, he said. The voice replied, "All in time, Homer Slard, all in time." All over the world that day and night, satellite links and internet servers overloaded and crashed with the wave of official and unofficial traffic that the visitor's appearance had caused. In the White House and in every foreign statehouse or palace, except North Korea, lights burned through the night. All regular programming on network and cable channels was preempted by footage and commentary about what had become popularly known as the ET standoff at County Road 6. Seriously concerned pundits on Fox News and Rush Limbaugh demanded an immediate nuclear strike on Homer's house. Seriously concerned pundits on MSNBC
and the Berkeley City Council demanded an immediate creation of a bipartisan blue ribbon commission of 12 members of Congress, 12 representatives of state and local government, and 7 unaligned citizen members, an African-American, a Latino, a Native American, and respectively a gay, lesbian, transgendered, and bisexual person, to consider the issue of, quote, alleged but potentially beneficial space alien intervention in national and international affairs, quote, the commission to report to the President and Congress in 6 months. In America and across the globe, various religious leaders claimed with great passion and reference to passages in their respective holy texts that the visitor most certainly was a personal representative of their own God or gods, come to earth to bring wrath upon disbelievers and deliverance to believers. Most of the world just waited for the next news bulletin. By the next morning, Homer's farm was encircled at a half-mile distance by a battalion of the Army's 82nd Airborne Division, airlifted in the evening before from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Within that perimeter, scores of Secret Service agents, FBI agents, the California Highway Patrol, and Fresno County Sheriff's deputies milled about cautiously, keeping a wary distance from the invisible wall surrounding the house. It was suspected by some that several more evangelists and alien abductees probies who had arrived and set up shop during the night were actually undercover operatives of foreign intelligence agencies. Periodically, Homer and the visitor would appear on the porch to wave at the congregants. On those occasions, reporters at the perimeter would shout questions to the visitor. What galaxy are you from? How do you like Earth so far? Do your people know about Lady Gaga? That night, a circle of bright spotlights bathed the house and its drawn curtains. There was no word forthcoming from the White House. At dawn the following day, the White House turned a day-glow green, as did the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and the Jefferson Memorial. The National Capitol turned a neon orange, the Pentagon a deep blue, although some observers thought it more of an eggplant purple. In London, Buckingham Palace turned a bright yellow, as did the Houses of Parliament. The Eiffel Tower turned red, the Kremlin blue. The pavement of Tiananmen Square turned a checkerboard pattern of red and blue. Elsewhere in the capitals of the world, state buildings and palaces appeared in vivid neon reds and greens, some in polka dot patterns. That afternoon, a black limousine with tinted windows drove up the road to Homer's house and was passed through the roadblock. The driver hurried to open the back door, and a distinguished-looking man in a dark suit stepped out and walked briskly to a point just opposite the house, stopping short of a white line now painted by the Army Corps of Engineers on the walkway. He shouted, "Hello in there, goddammit," and waited. Homer and the visitor came out onto the porch. "Yes," said the voice. The man cleared his throat and said loudly, "I am Walter J. Ledger, assistant to the assistant director of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. That's NASA, in case you don't know, spaceman. And at this time, I represent the president. He wants to know why the hell you, Mr. Whoever you are, want to see him." "I have important information for the president and for the other leaders of your world," said the voice. "Well, for God's sake, can't you be more specific?" said the president's emissary. "Not at this time," said the voice. "I must speak with the president." And Homer and the visitor went back in the house. The assistant to the assistant to the assistant director of NASA turned to return to his limousine, which now was a deep candy apple red with the word "fool"
in a white cursive script painted along both sides of the hood. There was still no word forthcoming from the White House, although confidential communications between the White House and rural capitals was intensive. By the next day, the Golden Gate Bridge had turned a dull olive. Mount Rushmore was blue, with the noses of the presidents red. The Statue of Liberty appeared to be wearing a brightly patterned Hawaiian muumuu. St. Peter's Basilica in Rome was coal black, and the Kaaba in Mecca brilliant white. At about the same time, every commercial FM radio station in the world began broadcasting Debbie Boone's recording of her 1977 hit, You Light Up My Life, over and over and over. On the AM band, every station incessantly ran a recording of Tiny Tim's Tiptoe Through the Tulips. At noon, the toilets in the United States Capitol reserved for members of Congress, those reserved for legislators in the 50 state capitals, and every toilet in all the major league ballparks and in soccer stadia around the world stopped working. Then, suddenly, none of the cars at NASCAR tracks could be started. By that evening, every can, bottle, and keg of beer in the world had turned stale, and Sports Illustrated magazine announced that all of the digital photos on file for the next year's swimsuit issue had mysteriously turned into photos of scantily clad male bodybuilders. The frivolity of these plagues was much commented on by pundits of the press and electronic media. The essence of their remarks was bewilderment that something more serious had not been engineered by the visitor. But that was before the next morning, when everyone in the world woke up colorblind. Within minutes, an engraved invitation to visit the president was in the hands of the Secretary of State, who sat nervously in Air Force One as it lifted up from Andrews Air Force Base, headed for Fresno. A few moments later, the people of planet Earth regained their color vision. And so it was that Homer and the visitor arrived in Washington to be greeted by the president and the national government and luminaries of all the religions and all the nations except North Korea. When the visitor walked slowly toward the president and quickly raised a hand in greeting, two Secret Service agents fainted. Four attempted to draw their weapons but found them somehow cemented in their holsters, and 16 others began to run toward the president to cover him with their bodies, but all tripped on some invisible obstacle and fell on their faces. After a moment, the president slowly raised his hand. The president and the visitor shook hands. The president smiled. The visitor smiled. Homer smiled. The members of Congress, the generals, the justices of the Supreme Court, the clergy, the ambassadors, and the multitudes on the Capitol Mall gave a collective sigh. So, welcome to Earth, sir, Mr. Visitor, said the president. The visitor smiled, and the melodic voice chuckled and said, Sir and Mister, are those official titles that you give to me, Mr. President? It's a matter of respect, said the president, as if he were speaking to a child. Here on Earth, at least here in America, it's a mark of respect to greet a man with the form of address of Sir or Mister. But, Mr. President, said the voice, why do you assume that I am male? The president's mouth dropped open. Oh, my God, he said. As you wish, said the visitor, but it really isn't necessary to be so formal. Think of me, Mr. President, as something like your mother. The president, his mouth still agape, and the visitor turned and began walking toward the White House. The honored entourage followed,
And as they walked, the president and every man there felt a strange sensation, as if he were being tugged along by his ear.
What is it you wanted to talk about? Said the president.
The visitor nodded, and the voice, which now was heard by everyone on Earth, even in North Korea, said, "Where to begin? Well, first of all, I'm quite concerned about all these wars you have, and the poverty and the violence you have, and in that regard, I simply don't understand your religions, most of which seem to assume superiority over all other faiths, and to treat all the others as sinful and unworthy. That just isn't nice, Mr. President. Well, then, why don't you and I just sit down and have a nice talk, and all your friends from the other parts of your earth can join us? I'm sure that all of you can work out all of these problems. With my help, of course." Homer Slard, only half listening to what the voice was saying, thought that after all this excitement, he might get around to painting his porch. Not right away, of course. He was looking forward to sightseeing in Washington, and he wondered if they'd have coffee at the executive mansion, which, as he looked up, seemed to be changing color from the day-glow green to a kind of sky blue. It reminded Homer of his mom's favorite color.
Was Jim Ashford reading Mayday. The story starts out at a Home Depot store right here in Fresno and involves a lonely local guy by the name of Homer Slard, who buys some solar LED garden lights, you know, the kind that the sun charges in the daytime so that they will glow at night. Well, it seems that a certain entity from outer space seems to think Homer's lights are a distress signal that involves our country. And before we know it, the whole world is dealing with a very real creature from beyond who, it becomes quite clear, they're not going to be able to handle so easily. Although the creature has the same features that we do, it's so tall that it bumps its head every time it goes in and out of doors. And what's so unusual, rather than the brutal enemy-adversary type that we generally associate with fictional aliens from outer space, the creature seems friendly, even has a sense of humor. It has the power to put its thoughts into your head, is able to stop you from using weapons, and can even make an invisible wall that will stop you from attacking. And when there is eventually a meeting in Washington with the president, everyone's assumptions about the gender of this all-powerful creature are shattered, and we're left to wonder how the leaders of the world are going to answer her challenges about ending war, violence, and religious hatred. With her help, of course. Folks, as we indicated in the beginning, Jim Ashford has been a steady and valuable supporter of our radio station. Not only that, He's also a steady and valuable contributor to Valley Writers Read over the past 10 years. By profession, Jim is an attorney who, before his retirement, served as legal counsel to California's legislature in Sacramento. Thanks for your story tonight, Jim. We're looking forward to receiving more from you in years to come. And so we come to the end of another segment of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Janet Nichols Lynch. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story. Until we meet again, good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.